Near-Death Experience Podcast, an ongoing exploration of spiritually transformative experiences, including NDEs and other phenomena, in order to elucidate the ineffable and better understand our spirituality. All episodes are available at ndepodcast.org. The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and guests are not necessarily those of NDE Podcast, the NDERF, any sponsors, or for that matter, anyone else. In the end, the only opinion that really matters is yours. Near Death Experience Podcast, item number 396, aka Patreon item number 007, July 19th, 2022. The NDE of Herbert M. Welcome back to Near Death Experience Podcast, the official podcast and source of audio counts for the Near Death Experience Research Foundation, NDERF. I'm your host, John Messer. Today, Chaz reads the NDE of Herbert M. There's a link in the show notes to the original post that Herbert placed on the NDERF website. As always, we thank those of you who listen and support the show any way that you do. It really helps to tell other people about us, to write reviews about us on iTunes. And a special thanks to those of you who do support us financially on Patreon. It is what keeps the show going. Thank you, thank you. And now, Chaz reads the NDE of Herbert M.
Welcome to Near Death Experience Podcast, Patreon Edition, episode number 7. I'm Chaz Hathaway, author of Life in the Spirit World, What Near-Death Experiences May Teach About Life on the Other Side. Today we've got an experience by Herbert from NDERF.org, which I hope you'll find as interesting as I find it. Herbert says, over some few years, as a group of friends, I had met with Vietnam veterans troubled by post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. My contribution to these men was one of support, listening to their stories as they became available. Part of the relationship we held was one of helping them to develop storytelling skills and to develop an environment of some spiritual dimensions within which to enable them to regain their individual sense of spirituality. I introduced them to Native American ceremony to establish common spiritual grounds without specific denomination, as these men had varied backgrounds in faith practices and denominations. As a matter of common humanity, it was necessary to establish a denomination-free environment. It seemed to be a common factor in combat veterans afflicted by PTSD to have either rejected the faith practices in their background or, more commonly, to have rejected and felt rejected by their faiths as a result of the casualties of armed combat. As the others in our group who met with these good men and women, the veterans, we each offered friendship, empathy, and affection to them. My own practice was that of fasting on the Saturdays we did meet. This helped me to prepare myself to literally walk in blood with these wonderful people. On Saturday, November 14th, 1992, we would meet as scheduled with a small group that had been meeting that we had been meeting with for some 5 years. For some reason, the veterans called in and variously excused themselves for the day. A good friend, Virgil C., the owner of the place where we met and held our Saturday sweats, decided to continue on with the ceremony for ourselves and our own needs. Some 45 minutes into the sweat ceremony, I had a feeling of heaviness and some discomfort within the left side of my chest, as if heat was accumulating there. Also, leaning on the colder ground seemed to relieve some of this pressure. I did have a mildly upset stomach, but I could attribute this to being on a fast. However, I asked to step outside and regain some breath. I felt some need to relieve the heat in my left side. Once outside, with a beautiful view of San Pablo Bay in the silence of the night, I just wanted to relax and let loose. The bay water seemed filled with bubbles of light that danced and moved, sometimes against the currents, in a kind of dance. I was very attracted to the unusual spectacle, but did not seek for any meaning or significance to it. It was just beautiful, and as I told my friend of this, he just agreed. Only later would he tell me that he never saw anything. We returned to the sweat lodge to complete the ceremony. The only out-of-place event that gave me some pause was that each time I would close my eyes to relax, I had the feeling of being somewhere else, on a journey across some field. But again, I dismissed it to tiredness and fasting. At the end of the third round of the sweat, the tightness in my chest begged me to end. I asked my friend for his opinion, and he agreed. We completed the ceremony according to tradition, a matter of respect, and left for his house where we could enjoy a light dinner. By now my stomach was really upset, but as I was fasting, I just did not attend to it. I took a piece of candy, and as I ate it, my stomach settled down. I thought this confirmed that my discomfort was due to a long fast, which I was breaking. I felt a little lightheaded, but nothing of concern. As we sat down to dinner, salami sandwiches and coffee, I suddenly got dizzy. My chest did not hurt. I felt as if I was being strangled, but I could breathe far more air than before. It felt as if my breastbone was being separated and torn apart. Now I did feel concern. My friend asked me if I was having a heart attack, and no, to speak the truth, I felt no numbness in the arm or jaw, and those symptoms, as those symptoms commonly listed. Of course, what he saw and what I felt must have been very different things, but I did find myself very concerned and asked him to take me to the local emergency services at Kaiser Permanente Hospital in Richmond, some 20 minutes away. He did, and I am grateful that he did so. As we left the house, I tried speaking to him, using some humor, and he looked very worried, and I did not want to impose upon him the discomforts of what I still thought were the results of my fasting throughout the day. Then I became aware of exiting the car through the window and watching my friend and a carcass fast fading down the street. The empty body beside my friend seemed to be me. I just thought it odd, as other events were beginning to take place. These I must reserve to myself until I can make good sense of them. After moving through the surrounding landscape, I found myself in the same place that had been in my thoughts during the ceremony. Open, broken, hilly grounds, with a path that led upward to the side of a nearby mountain. The path became a cobblestone path that, at the entrance of a tunnel, forked into the tunnel and also veered right toward a place of dirty lights where much noise was made. Two steps later, or so it seemed, I had covered a few hundred yards to the edge of a canyon that caused me great fear. Just a disagreeable, incomprehensibly ugly place, full of ashes, barbed wire, and burning torches that burnt with the yellow-green color of sulfur. Something inside of me held me back, and I found myself within the tunnel where I could see, through the walls, a field full of stone people. An inner voice quietly said that these are they who wait for the reality of intellect. Eyes lost in the distance, waiting for life as an idea to become a reality, as life went before them, free to be what it is. At the end of the tunnel, or the top of the stairs, there was a sliver of light. And there is where I went. I think I had an inkling of my own death at that moment, but I knew that I could not cross a threshold I could not see. As I turned to climb down the stairs, I fell backward and found myself on the other side of a gate that was not there. There was no way out. The place was an endless field, full of grass and flowers of all colors, and trees that sang quiet songs, and they were all welcoming me. Me? Who am I that they would do this? I thought, why would they welcome me? I took a path that continued toward a place where bright lights shone, some kind of structure full of people, by the thousands. And they all cheered and welcomed me. I knew that I am not any kind of a hero or person of importance, but they were rejoicing in that I had come. Then, out of the bright lights came members of my family, many dear people who we had lost over time. My grandfather, aunts, uncles, cousins, and even those whom I only knew in pictures. And my childhood friends and their relatives, and they all came to greet and welcome me. I could not make sense of what was going on, but I did suspect, I think, that I knew I was dying. Then there were some beings whose muscles were not flesh but flame. Fire contained within the shape of legs, arms, and so on, and full of light. They greeted me, and after they all left, only two remained. One that looked at me, somehow I knew, or am bound to know, someone of extreme importance to my life. But it left, climbed above the trees, and waited there. The other being was behind me. I turned to my family, but they had become quiet. The whole world had become silent, very silent. Then I became aware of a kind of light, shining with the brightness that is more than all the suns in the universe, white, bright, and crystalline, and very much alive. It stood before me. Somehow I knew that I could not come into that light, so I turned back, then up, then down. And there was no hiding from the light that took me into itself. I now knew that I was dead, and that whatever else were to be, it would so be now. This most holy being and spirit, the one whom no word can name or describe, took me into his arms and bid me welcome. Then he asked, "Are you done?" I instantly knew I was dead, and now was called to account for my small and unimportant life. I could not lie. In an instant that will last forever, I saw my life, from conception to death, as one single and whole event, not as separate parts of a jigsaw puzzle, but as a complete and inseparable whole. And I knew that my life was complete. I was done. The light, this most holy spirit, took me into itself in an embrace that will haunt me till the end of my days and beyond. For an endless instant, I knew love. And I knew myself loved beyond words and descriptions, just infinitely loved. And I saw through the eyes of spirit what spirit sees. There is no mind to understand that vision. It just is. Then the voice asked, "Is there anything you would like to do?" I did say that I would like a few minutes to set my family at ease, to leave no remorse nor regret for them, just for a few minutes to say one final, "I love you. Always have, always will." No matter what, our struggles, stupid fights, angry little moments, nothing ever kept us from being loving to each other. The one who is above all names released me from his embrace and said, "Go." I said, "No." And I was terrified. I had said no to what I hold most sacred. I knew that there is no life I could want any more without him. My desire for him was much greater than my petty little fear. The light said, "Go." And I said, no. The light said, go. And I began to feel a separation, a distancing. But as gift, there was that which the light gave me to see. Perhaps what lies within my own heart and soul as to what the faith I embrace promises. And I also saw that there is a point or a place beyond which one may not cross, for to do so, it makes everything else final. Some of these things of vision and feeling I have kept to myself. I know that I cannot explain them, nor give them meaning. And I cannot look for answers from others because their explanations eventually become empty speculation. And this is very painful. I think to understand that to be human is to be more, much more than we have allowed ourselves to be. And that there is so much possibility we deny ourselves as we become locked into being rational, into being limited by rational proof. This near-death experience thing is at once a blessing and a curse. As a minister, although minor clergy, I have had to reconcile as much as possible with tradition and teaching as my denomination expresses. And the truth is that there is almost no one whom one may query to seek out the terms through which to approach an answer. For 10 years, I left the ministry, embracing the quest for an answer. Unfortunately, it is not just an answer, and there is no answer to be really had. I had lived in a Native American reservation, though saints and holy people of other ways, and found mostly emptiness and speculation in the name of faith. I found myself embracing solitude rather than wasting time retelling a story. NDE is not a mandate, not a commissioning to holiness. I can, as any other human being, make a claim to holiness without ever being touched by the sacred. And the mindless repeating of story, a story that cannot ever be fully told, is loathe to me. I am a simple, uninteresting, semi-rational, ordinary human being. My wife sometimes doubts that. And I am constantly making mistakes, laughing about them or apologizing, and still in search of an answer. As far as I know, I was conscious of where I was, who I was with, and what we were doing. The Inipi sweat ceremony does keep you very much aware of that. That is the end of Herbert's experience. And how interesting, isn't it, that his struggle with trying to describe the sense of inability to gain answers here that are beyond answers there. It's like here the answer seems so empty and like a shell, while the answers there are so full and so infinite that they can't possibly be packaged into something that could be fully answered in this life. I think that is a good description that he gives of the difficulty in describing what people are experiencing in near-death experiences. Now, it's interesting to me how some people in their near-death experiences tend to go to a place or a situation and they kind of stay there for their experience, or maybe they go from one place to the next and then, you know, have a final place where they end up meeting a lot of people and most of their experience takes place there, while others seem to go on what appears to be like a journey. It's like several landscapes, one after another. I kind of think of it in terms of the places you go, you'll go journey, or maybe a better, more appropriate way to describe it would be some kind of vision quest type of thing, where they're going from one place to another, seeing different lifestyles, if you will, on the other side. I don't know if lifestyles is the right word, but different kind of outcomes and Even outcomes is probably not the right word, because outcomes sounds like a final destination. But Herbert sees in his, while he's doing his sweat lodge deal, he finds himself kind of drifting. And from the way he's describing it, it sounds like he feels like he's kind of like dozing off a little bit, just kind of out of touch with where he is. He keeps feeling like he's going on some journey across some fields, and he just dismisses it as being due to his tiredness and fasting. So he's finding himself on a journey across some field is what he, the way he describes it. And then as things tend to get, as things progress, because I guess they go on to get some food. As they sat down to dinner, salami sandwiches and coffee, he says, I started to get dizzy. My chest did not hurt. I felt as if I was being strangled. And, you know, he's feeling some severe pain that seems different than things he's experienced in the past, and doesn't seem to fit the description of a heart attack either. So he's, you know, not panicking, but he's kind of wondering what to do. So they head to the hospital, and on the way to the hospital, he leaves his body. His spirit leaves his body out the window, and then finds himself out looking back. And then as he turns and goes into this landscape that he sees, he finds himself in the same place he had been in his thoughts during his ceremony. Open, broken, hilly grounds with a path that led upward to the side of a nearby mountain. It talks about a cobblestone path that leads to it, the entrance to a tunnel, and then in the tunnel, it's this creepy place of ashes and barbed wire and burning torches with a yellow-green sulfur fire, and it's kind of an unpleasant place. It's not the kind of thing he wants to be. You could call this a distressing near-death experience because of this. However, it doesn't stay there, and so, you know, and yet most distressing near-death experiences don't stay in the distressing aspect unless they come immediately back without experiencing more. But he finds himself in this place with these what appear to be statues, stone people, as he describes them. Maybe not statues, but he says stone people. And then he gives this weird sentence that I'm not sure what to make of, but I find interesting. He says, an inner voice quietly said that these are they who wait for the reality of intellect. Eyes lost in the distance, waiting for life as an idea to become a reality, as if life went before them, free to be what it is. Now, I don't know whether this is some kind of metaphor that he is seeing, or maybe metaphoric reality that he's seeing, or maybe it is actually beings that, you know, are pondering on the idea of intellectuality and life on a mortal world, and they're just waiting for it, or they're just, you know, pondering the concept of it but never embarking on it. If they're real beings, then it may be reflecting a little bit of what people prior to coming to Earth may be at risk of falling into, looking forward to life always, but never partaking of it. But that seems like a little bit of a stretch to me. My own personal idea about things suggests that this is more likely something that he is experiencing as a lesson to him, as saying, don't wait for life to happen. Don't be constantly looking only to the future without progressing into it in a living now sort of way, if that makes any sense. So basically, you know, some people will live so much for the future that they never experience today. And I think that might be what it's warning him of. I don't know. I'm I have to speculate because he doesn't give any of his own insights of what he thought that was about. But, you know, there is that risk, you know, in preparing for tomorrow, which we should be doing. We should be preparing for the future, but not at the total expense of today. If everything that you're doing now is only for tomorrow, for some future that may or may not come to pass, then perhaps you should rethink a little bit of how you're doing things. Now, if you find yourself completely, utterly living in today, not even thinking about whether you should go out and get a job or whatever in case you might need money tomorrow or whatever, then you're probably on the other opposite extreme. But I think in today's modern fast-paced society, it's more common for people to fall into this waiting for the reality of tomorrow to come. I'm not sure what he means by the reality of intellect. Maybe living entirely in the mind and in the thoughts and in the logic and, you know, just not even giving a place for spirituality and thinking on and meditating on spiritual things and living in the moment. You know, it makes me think of something that has come back over the years. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was something that was, you know, maybe whispered from the other side, because it keeps coming back. Anytime I'm in a situation where I have a decision to make, and it may or may not seem important in the moment, but I'm having a hard time making the decision, I ask myself, what would be the best thing to do right now? Not necessarily what's, you know, in this long, you know, distant future, or perhaps, you know, for my selfish needs or something. What would be the most right thing to do right now? And when I find myself in those kind of situations, I usually make a decision that feels right for that moment, which is often the inconvenient decision, or it's often the decision that, you know, instead of studying, I'm serving a person, or something, you know, where the future kind of gets put on hold a little bit for the rightness of the choice that is to be made right now. And, you know, another way to think of it is, if I were to die tomorrow, which decision would I be glad that I made? And, you know, that's going to be different for different situations and different people. Sometimes the holding out faithful to this thing that I'm, you know, working toward might be the better thing, so that, you know, your children and legacy can say, he never quit. He was always willing to stick with, you know, the important thing and never quit. Or it could be that, you know, it's putting aside the things that are maybe in some distant future in order to do what is right in this moment, because it's right. Just doing something because it's the right thing to do. I don't know. That's just my own thoughts about it. But then he finds himself, or Herbert finds himself, in the next moment, he says, at the end of the tunnel, or at the top of the stairs, there was a sliver of light, and there is where I went. And there's a little bit of confusion. I was a little bit confused, I should say, in the next sentence and stuff. He's starting to get an inkling of maybe he's dead kind of thing. And he knew that he could not cross a threshold that he could not see. And I'm not clear, and if there's this threshold there that he can't see beyond, or if he can't see the threshold at all, but he knows it's there, or what. But he says, as I turned to climb down the stairs, I fell backward and found myself on the other side of a gate that was not there, and there was no way out. Very confusing wording, okay? So something is happening, and he finds himself going into a place and not being able to backtrack to where he was. I'm not sure what that is or how that works, but he says, the place that he finds himself in was an endless field full of grass and flowers of all colors and trees that sang quiet songs, and they were all welcoming me. And he seems overtaken by this sense of welcoming love and acceptance, because he's saying, me, who the heck am I that they would do this to welcome me? Every one of them singing these loving welcomes of love. He says, who am I to have that? And then he kind of goes on about that. He's like, I'm not of any importance and so forth. And in this process of kind of this journey, I guess you could say, he finds himself realizing that everyone is qualified for such a loving, joyful welcome. That's just who we are. We are loving, joyful beings. The universe is a loving, joyful being. And everything in the universe is intended to be a loving, joyful, welcoming being. And it's true that we can choose otherwise, which is manifest in many of the distressing characters that are sometimes met in these experiences. We can choose to be unkind. We can choose to be cruel. We can choose to go against our loving nature. We can choose that. But it is our nature to be loving, kind. And only in being loving and kind can we really progress, can we really move forward. And then he finds, I assume in this field, these beings whose muscles were not flesh, but flame, and the fire contained within the shape of arms, legs, and so on. So it's like these beings whose arms and legs are made of fire. And I'm not sure what to make of that, except it kind of reminds me of, you know, this cherubim, description of cherubim and the flames sometimes surrounding them. I don't know if that's what these are that he is seeing, but it kind of reminds me of that. And then this cherub, or whatever it is, leaves. It climbs up above the trees, I assume flies up above the trees, and waits there at the top of the trees. It almost sounds like it's kind of taking on a sentinel type of position, a position of protection and looking after things. So I find that interesting. And then he finds himself, he says, the other being was behind me. I turned to my family, but they had become quiet. The whole world had become very silent. So his family that was there, these people among him who he knew, and he'd, you know, we didn't comment on that, but people that he'd known from family, you know, friends of family, you know, family of friends of family, and family of friends from school, and I mean, just like everybody was there to greet him. And that was part of this, who am I to be greeted in such a way, and so forth. But as everybody silences, he finds himself in the presence of a being of light that he says was shining with a brightness that is more than all of the suns in the universe. And his efforts to describe are just woefully inadequate in the way he puts it. It can't be described. You can't name this being. It's just not possible, because any attempt would be woefully inadequate, which is to say it was an ineffable experience, an ineffable being of just incredible light and love and joy. He just describes being infinitely loved. And he saw through the eyes of spirit what spirit sees. There is no mind to understand that vision. It just is, he says. I love that. And then he gets in this kind of, not exactly argument, but I mean, you know, he gets the impression that he's done what he set out to do in his life. But then he's asked, is there more that you would like to do? As if to say, you've accomplished your purpose, but do you want to do anything else while you're there? And he says, you know, I wouldn't mind just very few minutes to say one final I love you to my family, to tell them that I always loved you, I always will, no matter what, our struggles, stupid fights, angry little moments, nothing ever kept us from being loving to each other. that we, I will always love you, kind of thing. And then what happens here, I'm a little confused about, because it sounds like he wants to go back just for a few minutes to say goodbye and I love you, but then the being says go, and he immediately fights it. No. And I suspect, I can't, you know, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I suspect that that go that is being communicated to him is a go packaged with return to your life, a whole, you know, package of go back and continue your life, and 'cause he says no, and he says he was terrified for saying no to this being, and yet he couldn't not say no, because he wanted to stay with this being, and he's like, this is all I ever wanted, this is so much better than any of my petty fears or whatever, and so forth. I want to stay. And so perhaps it is being communicated that the go is not just go back and have your few minutes to say goodbye and I love you, but rather go back. And so next thing he knows, despite his arguments, he is going back. And, you know, he kind of goes into this discussion of being locked in. You know, we as being, we're locked into the rational. We're limited by rational proof. And he says, ugh, it's all so hard to quantify, and everything that people say seems to end up, you know, in a spiritual sense or in a religious sense and so forth, everything seems to come down to just empty speculation. And I can see what he's, I think I see what he's saying, is that when you've been in the presence of that light and that love and so forth, any description, any effort to package that in any way that's communicatable on this earthly level just ends up breaking down into empty speculation. It you can't quantify it. And that's what I kind of get out of that anyway. And I could be wrong, but that's what I'm gathering. And I guess lest any of us think that, oh, you know, I want to have my own such experience, he does say that this NDE thing is at once a blessing and a curse. And perhaps that's part of the reason why. The ability to reintegrate into life after going through that. Wow. Just wow. So anyway, if you would like to leave your own message, if you would like to share your own experience or ask a question, you can do that by emailing neardeathexperiencepodcast@gmail.com. And to all of you who are contributing to the podcast, because you're the ones who can hear this. If you're hearing this, it's because you're a contributor. Thank you so much. I can't tell you what it means to me to have this kind of support. It really does keep me going. Life is busy, life is stressful, and I do really enjoy doing this, but having you make these contributions just makes me think, yeah, it is so worth it, because people are willing to reach out in this way and willing to contribute. I've got to keep it going. I've got to keep doing it. And it's not that I feel, you know, pressured to do it. I want to do it. But having this extra boost provides incentive that goes beyond just the, you know, passion project level. This is doing something for people, and clearly it's something worth doing. So I just wanted to say thank you, both for your contributions, for listening. Thank you all so much for your patronage and your support.